Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome to, well, what I think, and it's my podcast, is a very special, very important episode to go with our future history week. What do you reckon, Zach?
Yep, this is, we've been building up to this, haven't we? So we recorded a few back along, and then we decided that we needed more history of the future, and particularly the history of the future of history.
Yeah,
if so that makes any sense.
This week we've done like climate change, a history of climate change, what it means for the future. What else have we done? Drone warfare we did as well. So we've done some quite particular ones. But then I said to you, damn it, we need a panel. We need a panel like the time we all screamed about the statue thing, about diversifying history. And this is so topical at the moment, isn't it? And you went out and found a panel. And you know what, Zach? I'm just going to leave it to you to host this, because you've put it together and you've done quite a scary looking list of points as well. But we basically, it's not that scary, and this is History Hack, so we are going to chuckle and we are going to laugh and stuff. But I think it's important to talk about how we make sure going forward that history isn't all about the history of white men, which, to be fair, it has been for a very long time. Yeah, go on, Zach.
Yeah, too right. It has. And it's got really quite tedious. So we are joined by some of our, I think it's fair to say, some of our favourites, Alex. Not that we, you know, have a disliking for any of our guests, but
very favourites, though.
Yeah, we do have favourites.
People are cancelling their subscriptions right now.
Basically, if we were going to do a shortlist of who we could go drinking with that had been on History Hack, these people would be on that list.
Yeah, we haven't shut up about these three for pretty much ever since we last recorded with them. So we are joined by Holly Pinero, who is Assistant Professor at Furman University. Folks will remember his brilliant podcast recently on the families in the USA during the American Civil War, Black families specifically, and their experiences during and then particularly after the Civil War. It was a brilliant podcast. Folks, go back and have a look at it. His book, The Families Civil War, is out soon with the University of Georgia Press. And I didn't realize this until we were talking before we went on air, as it were, but you're the first African-American to be tenured as a professor in your department. Is that right?
That's the dream. So I'm tenure track, you know, on track, I guess, to get tenure. There was someone here who was non-tenure track. And I'm happy to talk about that and the weight that has been put on my shoulders in terms of just like, I should not be a trailblazer. Like, I like to study trailblazers, but that even goes to other institutions I've worked at where I was either the third or the fourth single digits. And this is at R1s as well. So that's a whole nother conversation.
I mean, I would say that certainly myself and Alex are not surprised that you are a trailblazer on the grounds of your research, but
I'll take
that. For you to be a first is kind of like, for real. We're also joined by Matthew Restall, who folks will remember from a couple of podcasts we've done on the Aztecs and the Maya. Matthew is Professor of History, Anthropology and Women's Studies and is Director of Latin American Studies at Pennsylvania State University. And again, folks, go back, listen to the Maya podcast, listen to the Aztec podcast. They were brilliant. And we are joined by Amara Solari. Amara is Professor of Art History and Anthropology and Director of Graduate Studies in Art History at Pennsylvania State University, and joined Matthew, because they're a husband and wife duo, on the podcast on the Maya for what was a brilliant kind of bust up between the two of them about, well, it wasn't that much of a bust up. I mean,
you tried to make it a bust up.
I might have stirred it slightly.
Yeah.
But Amara, you were the first female professor of art history within your department as well. Is that right?
To earn the title of full in the department, yes. I think we hired my boss technically at the full level, but she came from elsewhere. So nobody had actually been granted full while they've been at the university.
It's insane, isn't it? There's 2021.
It's insane.
And we're not singling out any institution because we've been talking before we started recording. And this is pretty standard across the board. I mean, Amara, you joked. You do art history. Art history is all women, right?
All women. But I mean, nowadays, pretty much, not completely, but let's say 85%, maybe 90% women. Yeah.
But who have those women been studying traditionally in art history? Mostly, aren't they? Haven't they been studying like white men?
Dead white dudes? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
From
like how we need to blow up art history.
From,
yes,
from Italy, not to be.
Oh,
not
from,
there's anything wrong.
Not
with
just
Italy,
but like Tuscany. Like you have to be from Tuscany.
Yeah. I guess one
get
thing
in trouble already.
Yeah, what we want to do is talk about, I guess we need to start by talking about what the problem has been. And the problem is that the focus has been too narrow and that we have all been obsessed with white dudes for a very long time. So I guess the problem is the problem historiography, which is a word that makes us all just want to go because it's the first thing they teach you undergrad year one and you just think, oh God, no. So, I mean, like Holly, interestingly, before we started, you said, what's the first thing that springs to your mind when we talk about historiography?
Racism,
yeah.
Exclusion, if we're using one word, misogynistic, and just, you know, I think, and I can only speak for my subfields, right? Because I'm a gender historian, African-American historian, Civil War, 19th century, 20th century. You know, I think of, for many, generally, right, when they hear historiography, they feel like it's dull. And I'm going to the points other panelists made, because it's privileging, usually, historically, select groups of people, and even that, like, very small subset. You know, but I also have to remind myself when I talk to my students about historiography is that it's shaped public discourse for generations. If we're talking about the Civil War, going to the Dunning School, right? Like I remember when I figured out what that was in undergrad and I was like, wait, that makes sense as to why, you know, this white supremacist rhetoric and historical worship of these oppressors, of these races, of these insert horrific and correct adjective to describe them, why it was normalized. Having said that, I'm like many others, I'm trying to emphasize what USCT veterans who became historians were doing, that they are using historiography to empower themselves and their people, right? But they're also critiquing even those who are talking or not talking about the Black military experience. And in my book, I'm latching on to many other scholars who are saying, look, Black people have been trying to make their history known for a long time. And maybe it wasn't published and disseminated in the way that white scholars were, but Carter G. Woodson was learning about historiography and it was a way to empower. So Dubois is doing this phenomenal work, many others, right? You know, even Susie King Taylor is documenting her lived experiences and unemployment issues for her veteran husband. And that's part of the historiography. So it's a way to talk about Black women's experiences in the Civil War, which I'm trying to do with my second book is say, look, Black soldiers knew very well that the war was gonna be won with Black women's involvement in every sense of the word. They were the war. Historiography has privileged white women, North and South, but Black women, other particularly Northern Black women or Black women in the Midwest seem to just be at the periphery. Even though if you read most books, they'll say, Black women did this, Black women were there, they're there, they're here, they're doing. So yeah, historiography, even though the word can sound scary or boring, it's like, I'm trying to push along with people like Hillary Green and many others to say there's been a systemic problem with how historiography has been co-opted to push agendas that are very exclusive and say, why can't we recenter conversations on Black families, Black women and others?
Let's go to Zach as well, but is this because, like, I'm going to say now that I have been told as a brown historian before, yeah, but like, the Indians didn't write stuff down or the ethnic people didn't write it down. So that's why it's all the point of view of this. And so, or is it that, or is it just where we've chosen to put the lens?
Can I come straight in there? Because this is what I was going to say. Isn't part of the problem here the people who were doing the writing? You know, we have this, one of the things that we kind of picked out as one of these points to discuss is the old tradition of history to focus on inverted commas, heavily emphasized here, the great men right. of history. Right. Lots of problems there in what you're choosing to clarify as quantify as great in the first place, focusing on men, i.e. only telling half of the story in terms of humanity. And the focus, it goes back to kind of grand narratives where people were writing, well, as the kind of word suggests, they're writing the story, but they're writing a story very specifically from their perspective. And all these people who are writing these things, these books that have been handed down to us and are now 100, 150 years old, they're all white men looking at it through the lens of white men in positions of quite considerable privilege, usually sitting at somewhere like Oxford or Cambridge. And that has then shaped the following discussions, because when you start off reading one of these narratives, you're starting off in a very particular mindset. And actually the challenge becomes putting yourself into a different position and saying, actually, forget what's gone before. Let's take a fresh perspective. And it's only more recently that we've started to embrace that.
Yeah. Do you, are you finding exactly the same issues in the field of South America when you look at stuff?
Well, for sure, because we, I mean, in Latin America, we already have a colonial and now neo-colonial legacy, right? So you already have Europeans being primarily the people who, from the colonial period, on, you know, from 1492, controlling that particular narrative. And as Holly was speaking, I was thinking so much, and Zach as well, so much of what you are both kind of speaking around is the privileging of text and the privileging of writing, and who has access to education and who has access to writing and publication venues nowadays. And so I think from my perspective, what really has to happen if we're going to dismantle this kind of myth of that historiography has placed before us is we have to really give full credit to alternative forms of knowledge production. Because if we start to do that, then this issue of who's writing things down doesn't really matter anymore, right? Because you have indigenous groups who don't have writing systems, but they damn well know their history, and they have different ways of recording it, whether it's in art or orally, you know, incredible ways of recording this history. And it's deep, it's not generational, right? This goes back centuries. And so I think we have to get over the Western obsession with text. And until that happens, I honestly, you know, kids, our students, adults, they believe what they read, right? And so if things are written down, particularly if they're written down a really long time ago, there's assumed to be a kind of truth value there. And I think that needs to be exploded.
I think as well, like we talk about, oh, but like, okay, so an African-American woman did not sit down and write a two-volume history of the American Civil War. But as Holly has proven, an African-American woman sent 800 pages worth of correspondence to the US government, which exists still today, about her experience of the Civil War. Are we, or have we been lazy as well in terms of gathering?
Oh, now you got my blood going. So I'll just make this point. Like, I've had the privilege of having a graduate advisor who had our classes immersing ourselves in the Civil War pension records. And they're phenomenal. And they're not just for Black soldiers and families. They're for anyone who files. And they go to the revolutionary period through now. You know, they talk about history of disability. They talk about familial dynamics. They talk about education. They talk about unemployment. They talk about marriage. I was trying to, and I realized you all, but the listeners won't, but you know, here are testimonial documents of people telling their lives, and not just the individuals that are trying to get the pension, but someone, you know, saying, hey, I knew Alex. And actually, let me tell you my story real fast, because this is the only opportunity I have to do it. You know, and then the invalid claims, there's marriage certificates, there's all this documentation that it's always been there. And that's why when people, I'm like always a little weirded out when they're like, your work is so revolutionary. I'm like, it's always been there. Yeah. It's not like Black women's voices have always been there in the record. My advisor knew it. You know, everyone, like they clearly knew it. The only thing I'm doing is taking things like the census, which is super dry. And but it does give you this way to understand who is living in these places. How is the federal government assessing, usually in a racist, misogynistic way, but still they're in the record. And even if they're not, it's being transcribed. and it's usually done through a white lens, is that their voices are the centerpiece. And someone else can flip it and look at children specifically. I mean, there's so much richness to how we look at sources that have always been there. Because one of the bigger points I'm arguing is the lost cause is crap. Because if you look at Civil War pension records, the federal government is documenting and awarding and recognizing Black military service long into the when lost cause is entrenched. So the federal government through the pensions is actually saying, that's a lie. We do remember. And I'm not saying it's a blissful experience to get on the pension, but they're remembered.
Yeah. I mean, so my stuff at the moment is like self-inflicted wounds, and there's not one single mention of it in the official medical history of the Third World War. There is one throwaway reference to suicide as well. It's as if this did not happen. And yet the stuff is there anecdotally. It is there in military records as well, but it's just there's nothing centralized. But once you start digging, it is there. And once you start digging, it becomes clear very quickly that the British Army in World War One was more sensitive than you think they were to people's mental health before, and I'm talking before the latter half of the war, when they started to get really into the idea and they sort of moved on from a definition of shell shock and assuming it was like vibrations from the shell, right, and started dealing with it as mental health issues and opening up special hospitals and things like that. But before that, they're saying to these guys, I've got a list of guys who did it, and they're going, well, you're not capable of holding a rifle and being in a frontline thing. I'm moving you to a labor unit. I'm moving you to the engineers. I'm moving you back from the front line so that I can still use your contribution. And I need manpower and I need labor, but I recognize that you should not be in the fighting line because of your mental health. So this, you're right, the stuff is there. And I think personally that what we've done is inherit a laziness for the sort we look at from generations before us. This isn't just that we all woke up racist and thick and decided not to look. This is how people have been taught to be historians for generations now.
I think this, and I'll just close with this point, is like, I think you're hitting on something really, really important, is that to me, it demonstrates that there's a problem with the profession in terms of who are in leadership positions, who's in the front of the classroom. And I say this, I love my advisors from undergrad. I went to community college, I went to grad school, but I only had, through my entire collegiate experience, two Black professors. Like, I'm talking major and small schools. And I remember saying to my undergraduate professor, look, I love you and you've been very instrumental in shaping the way I think and see things, even myself, but you'll never really get Black history the way I do or others like me, because you do it because it's interesting versus I do it because it's an obligation. I have to tell these stories. And I say that because when I teach students, Black students in particular, they'll say, you talk about history the way we talk about it with our family. And I'm like, yep. And I'm gonna make them hear it. I'm gonna make them see what we know has always been there. So it's like, again, Carter G. Woodson, Dubois, like all these people have been doing it. I'm just glad to be, you know, in that realm. I'm not saying I'm them, I'm not, but just like that, I'm trying to empower to tell stories where we need, you know, people who are from those communities. They're going to tell it in a way that's more, I don't want to say real, right? Like it's more personal, I think. And that makes it more, the passion's there. Like when people see me talking, like, you're so passionate, I'm like, I want you to understand Black people matter. I don't care what period of time. I want you to understand women matter. Right, we don't need to talk about white men. They can be pushed to the background, right? Like, because they've had their time.
When you were speaking, Holly, earlier, I was thinking, you know, you were kind of advocating, we were talking about the archive, right? And what the archive can lend. And I was thinking, well, he's really talking about a kind of profound methodological shift, but you're not. You're talking about like a methodological pivot. And Alex, you as well, right? Where you read, like Matthew's work so often, he's reading the same sources that people have read, but just with this kind of different lenses, this different perspective. And it's amazing to me, the different narrative that can be elucidated by just slightly looking for a particular kind of information in a particular way. And then the whole kind of tapestry of human history becomes so much more complex, right? And it's not this unidirectional evolutionary model of like the great white man, you know, progress, progress, progress. In my field, the term genius, right, is always applied. Like, right. Name a female artist who's considered a genius in the art historical trope. It doesn't exist.
Matt, do you want to, you haven't got a word in edgeways.
Well, isn't that appropriate?
But the two white men in the room can't get a word in edgeways. I love it. I mean,
maybe revolution for the whole hour, every time Zach and I open our mouths, you just say, zip.
Yeah.
That would be just fine. I mean, that would be fine. I've had plenty of time, in the last half century to talk. No one wants to hear. But seriously, historiography, I haven't said anything, but haven't you been really answering that question? Why is historiography, why do we have that reaction? This is a boring, dull word. I certainly do. It's actually a really good question. It's like, why does it seem boring? And I think it's because, obviously not in our classes, but traditionally, what historiography is telling somebody, this is the canon. These are the foundational works. These are the ones you need to know about and understand. And, they are usually, written by white men, often, about white men. I'll come and get to that in a minute. And it doesn't open your mind. It's not about opening your mind, about questioning, about his received wisdom. Now, how can we kind of dismantle it? It's about accepting that received wisdom as part of your training, right? So that you then kind of become part of this system. And I think instinctively we kind of sense the boringness of that our minds are being kind of closed off. But what we have not been sufficiently led to is understanding that the entire system has been created in the era of values that to us are profoundly racist and sexist and colonialist. I'm talking about like late 19th, early 20th century. So the peak of the imperial period, right? When almost everybody in the world was part of a colony, running a colony, a colonial subject, whatever it is. When, think of what was happening in the United States in the late 19th century, for example, right? And that's the era when these disciplines are being created, not just history, all of them. And therefore the relationship that the disciplines have with each other, with the past, like, when do you get to study, Indians? And when do you get to study, the arrival of, civilization and all the kind of like colonialist racist stuff in our field. And there's the equivalent in Holly's field as well. It's all built into the structure. And so it's not enough to say, look, let's just start writing books about the great white men. Now let's add in the people who've been missing. I mean, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. We've all been doing that. But it's just a step. It has to be just a step towards something else in which all these kind of barriers are all broken down. And while I'm talking, because once you guys start up again, I won't be able to get a word in. I'm interested in Holly, what you think about this whole, this idea of who you get to study based on who you are. And this is something that has, I kind of have been wrestling with for my whole career, right? Mm-hmm. Right from when I had my very first job in a small college in Texas, and I was teaching Mexican history. Mm-hmm. And I had Mexican-American students whose families had been in Texas since it was part of colonial Mexico, right? And a couple of these guys said to me, kind of reminded me when you were talking about the things you said, Holly, to your undergraduate professor, said, I love what you're teaching us and no one has told us about this stuff before, but you can't possibly really understand. You can't really possibly have that knowledge because only someone who's a Mexican-American can really understand and should therefore study Mexican-American history. So there I got into this debate. I was like, but surely that's wrong. Surely everybody should be able to study everything else. I mean, it's about the ability of our intellect to apply ourselves to any subject, right? It isn't the whole point that the color of our skin shouldn't matter.
Right.
And that was kind of the position I took. But then, over the years, I realized it's like, you know what? I can study whoever I like. I've written books about people of indigenous descent and African descent, mm-hmm. because that's part of my privilege. I get that choice, right? As you said earlier, it's like, you're doing this because you're curious, because you're interested. But if someone who doesn't look like me, who hasn't had the benefits and advantages and privileges that I've had, do they get that kind of choice? No, they don't. And so therefore, again, it's about a step, right? Like I love to think that we could be in a world where you, Holly, are writing books about the Maya, right?
Right.
And I'm writing books about, you know, Black families in the American Civil War. Now, are our perspectives going to be better than Maya's writing about Maya's or African Americans? No, that's not about better or worse. It's about multiple perspectives, right? And it's about choice. It's about who, it matters who you are, and yet it doesn't matter, right? It matters who you are because you have a unique perspective on your subject as your students are picking up on, right? But at the same time, it also doesn't matter in that we want to get to a place where you can study whomever, whatever you like. It doesn't matter what those people look like and what their experiences was. And also, going back to what Amara was saying, it doesn't matter whether you're studying text, what kinds of forms of communication and record you're studying. That shouldn't put you in a pigeonhole. Like, oh, I'm sorry, you're digging holes in the ground and pulling up bones. Therefore, your conversation is completely different. Your vocabulary has to be different. You're in a different department. I mean, I'm ranting now, but I'm coming to the end. I don't see this getting that much better in terms of the disciplines. I see that there's a hardening that has been taking place, right, where the disciplines are kind of pulling apart from each other. And the more we talk about crossing these divisions, the more there's kind of a hardening, that, because it's scary, right? What happens? You're going to burn the whole house down and build it from scratch. Then we
yes.
But then what about tenure, right? People
get almost like, yes, on my
computer. That it all. Burn it down. Start.
So
again.
I was just before I forget, like Matt, as you were talking, like you made me think of a conversation I had in grad school about like a methodology course that I hope these people aren't listening. That was like I did not leave that particular class enthused with like this is what we do, like this is the tradition, and I hate those kind of words. And I remember saying when we were reading like Hegel and some other people, and I said during class once, I go, you know why this stuff sucks? I said, this all sucks to me because it's exactly what you said before. These are old white men. And are you telling me nothing has changed in the field since they wrote it? I can't, and I remember saying this, I can't go to Harlem and I can't go to Compton and go talk to some people on the corner about this history and why it matters. If I'm using Hegelian like language, they're gonna be like, shut the heck up. So I've always made it my responsibility with how I engage with the work, how I write about it, how I talk about it, to make it to when I could give my book or give a talk to your neighbor. So when I talk about my research, I talk to people who are military families like myself, and I don't give the jargon, right? Even now my undergrad classes, they're getting critical race theory. They don't know it, right? Like, but they're getting it. But they're getting feminist theory. They're getting all these like these theories. I'm just not hitting them with things like, yeah, by the way, you're learning infrapolitics, even though they're learning infrapolitics. Imagine communities. Because I want them to understand, like, this is engage. Let's have fun. History, you know, archaeology, art, like, why can't we just have fun engaging with it? To your question or the internal debate, like, you're hitting on something I struggle with, to be clear. I am a gender historian. One of my advisor was, like, one of the OGs for, like, you know, gender history. And it's helped me understand who I am and better understand the people in my life and the people I interact with. So even my mother, who's a military veteran, I use her as a lived example when I talk about military history through a gendered lens. I'm like, so she's a single woman raising three kids and served in the military, including going into combat zones. So is she my mom? Society says that's a male responsibility, you know, historically. So she's doing a dad, you know, the father, man's role. So is she my mom or my dad or my dad mom? Or how about she's just my mother? and that's all the other parts. But at the end of the day, she's my mother. But I say all that to say I will never claim, you know, that when I do my gender history and particularly focus on women, that I am the you know, I know all the answers. I know, you know, just because I read it doesn't mean I can speak to what any woman or person experiences. I think the way I try to check myself is I always ask other scholars who live those kinds of experiences, like, how am I doing with this? Am I being sensitive to it? But I also yield the floor. So if Amara was like, yeah, I don't think that's right. Actually, I would say it's this. Okay, because I don't live and understand the world in the same way as anyone like other than me. I want it for me, you know, it's about making history more personal, getting students excited. And I'll just close with this. I think the one thing that I try to do, which I encourage all of our, you know, people who are in leadership, particularly educational roles, is sometimes just tell a student, have you thought about going to graduate school? Or have you thought about doing this? Have you thought about working in a museum? Or, you know, have you thought about doing archaeology? Something, it's like, you clearly like this. Because most times I like history, but, and I'm like, oh, why did you stop there? Like, just like, so it's like, and I've noticed with some of my students, I'll write on their papers, you should think of grad school. Because I at least want to put that idea that I see the potential in them. I'm not saying they're going to go, but like, at least they know that someone of authority sees that you have the potential. Like my students in my survey course are reading Laboring Women. That's a book I read in grad school and I didn't understand it. And these students who are sophomore and freshman are like, oh yeah, they're talking about this. And I'm just like, y'all smart. You're so dumb. You're so smart. Are
smarter than me. I wonder if it's like we've got to a point where, yes, the trailblazers like Holly are the first people that are going to come along and go, I am an African American and I want to tell African American stories. But do we not, the next phase and what we need to do, because none of us are old, we're all going to be knocking around for a while, barring incidents with buses or COVID. So is it our job in this generation to make it so that all of the kids coming through don't automatically opt for the white man lens, so that their minds are open to going, well, I don't have to just write about the white dudes because there were more people than that there, and I'm going to write about everybody, or I want to focus on African Americans just because I can. Is that where we go next, Matt?
What Holly was saying got me thinking about the discipline of history, which, you know, we just were kind of bagging on that discipline, but what is it that we do as historians, I mean, specifically me and Holly, I guess, here in the conversation, we take multiple sources and lines of evidence and attempt to triangulate them, right? The more different perspectives we have, and particularly ones that completely contradict each other and go get, then that's when we know we're getting somewhere, because history is based on what people who mostly are dead have said about what happened. And as we know, human memory is intrinsically unreliable, right? So we do that as historians. And yet when we present history to the world, when we writing our books and teaching our classes and so on, somehow we forget that and we expect them just to take one line of evidence, right? And so if we're gonna take the sort of the philosophy that is underpins our discipline, and apply it to how we teach history, then we need to be able to show them that there are different stories and different perspectives, and those come from people who look different and have had different experiences. Right. Have to be able to take classes with people who are from all different parts of the world, right, and have different backgrounds and different perspectives and so on, and to see how those don't always kind of match up.
And right? It's so obvious when you think about it. So in this room, you have a black man, a brown girl, a female professor, and two white men. And if you asked all of us what our opinion was on Donald Trump, I guess it, they might be quite similar, but we would have.
So I think we're not aligned.
Not a good example. I think Donald Trump and Tottenham would be the same response.
Yeah, pretty much. We would have five opinions. And the idea that history and historians in the past would have tried to come up with one argument and said, well, this is how people felt about this. There aren't even five people in this room who would agree on a subject. And that's, being a historian is not, it's like the old myth about how everyone loved the idea of the First World War and everybody went out to Buckingham Palace and celebrated and went, yay, let's go bash the Hun. Bullshit. Actually, none of the working class people did, because they were working 16-hour days and they couldn't leave their factory, so they didn't go. The only country where that might be true and you actually have working class people in the pictures is Russia. In St. Petersburg. Everywhere else, they're middle-class crowds of university students with nothing better to do that day. It's not about coming up and saying, this is what the people thought, because the people doesn't exist. And I think that's what annoys me when I read history books.
Ooh, I just did that with my talking about the Constitution yesterday. So the students are freaking out when I was like, here's what the founding fathers actually said about who should have democracy and political power. And they're like, oh. Yeah, I was like,
we the people, as in a few of us white guys over here in the corner. Zach, you want to pause that? He's still here.
I am still here. I'm just, there are times when you know that you've got nothing valuable to contribute to a brilliant conversation. And that's one of them. You know, that's the trick of podcasting, that sometimes you don't insert your voice into a conversation where it's not needed. Before we move on, I have a question that I wrestle with a lot, and it kind of taps into something that I think Matthew was sort of alluding to. We have history months. So we have a Women's History Month. We have a Black History Month. And in one sense, I love those ideas, because obviously the point of those is to create a really intense focus on stories that up until now we have neglected. On the other hand, I have a fundamental problem with them, in the sense that every month should be Black History Month and Women's History Month.
My favourite one is Remembrance Day. Some guy pulled me because my poppy had fallen off my jacket on November the 10th last year. I went, why aren't you wearing a poppy? It's Remembrance Day. I went, dude, every fucking day is Remembrance Day for me. It's my life. It's my job. And he just, I think he looked at me like, oh, back away from the crazy lady now.
You have a bumper sticker with that. Yeah. Every fucking day is Remembrance Day.
Exactly.
Right.
But it is. It's like every month is Black History Month for Holly. Why is it four weeks a year?
So Hillary Green,
that group, and go, we see you. We should.
So Hillary Green and I have a joke about that, and a number of other of Black scholars in general, right? Not just historians, like, because Black History Month is an opportunity to sell it, like, from the historical perspective. Like, I see the value and why it was, you know, pushed forth. But it's right around mid-January, I start going, oh God, it's coming. Because I look at the unpaid labor and the excessive work that voluntold, and people are like, we have this great opportunity, you know, or the same could be said for women. You know, also, if I want to get jaded, why is it got to be the shortest month of the year in America? That's all another conversation. right. And even Juneteenth, like, people are celebrating it, and I am, but there's also the Civil War historian in me that's like, oh God, I know what this means for my labor. Right, because now I have to do this, you know.
You're going to get lots of exposure in bunny quotes, doesn't it?
Because for me, it's like, why can't I talk about Black history in November? Why can't I talk about women's history in January? They always is there. It's like even saying U.S. history and then having a Black history or a women's history course. Like, no, when I teach the survey, you're getting Native American, you're getting, you know, white European, you're getting all of it. It's not just, you know, native-born white men, whatever. It's like, this is all American history. It's messy. And it's like, we need to talk about, you know, people talk about this melting pot society. Well, then you need to incorporate that into how we discuss, remember, write, you know, history, or just in general, right? Beyond even this field, archaeology, whatever. It's just, it's not, every day is a day to reflect on. You know, I even think of Memorial Day and, you know, Veterans Day in the U.S. Like, I don't like those days because people think of them as holidays, right? Like, I'm going to go barbecue with my friend. And I'm saying here, like, as the child of a veteran, like, seeing what she and many of her friends have and still go through, it's like, we need to remember them all the time, right? And I'm not saying, like, parades and stuff, but, like, it should be like a
just decent housing,
right? But it, medical care, right? Yeah. I was going to say the medical care, that's the one I get the most angry about. You know, people will talk about, you know, homelessness here in this country, and I'm like, you know, a lot of those people, you know, historically have been military veterans, and there's a problem with that. So when you say get a job, insert derogatory term,
what's the American stat? It's one a day suicide.
It's horrific. And so it's like, those are the things that's like, we need to remember in meaningful ways, right? Not just say, oh, it's Women's History Month tomorrow, why don't you come talk now? You're like, really? Where was, like, thanks, next month? Right, because then it's like they're remembering and tokenizing you at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And that's how I view that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think exactly.
Like, I'm available other than February. I'm just saying.
Just saying, I don't go into an 11-month hibernation and just to be Black again next
month. Like, now's my time. All right.
Yeah. I'm going to put my shiny outfit on and come out.
Yeah, let me get my dashiki. Everyone. I'm ready. Let's do this.
Definitely. Did that answer your question?
I had to think of the equivalent for Matthew and I, but I think it's probably Columbus Day, right? Or Indigenous Peoples Day. That's when it heats
up.
I have to
talk about that next week. Every year I get asked to talk about that, and every year I feel less and less comfortable talking about it. Right. I mean, in a way, or in a perverse way, I'm a good person to talk about it because I'm not Italian or Italian American or Indigenous or any of the kind of groups, but also really why? I mean, I think that there's a sense in which there's two things going on. One is the kind of siloization, right? Like if you just have one month that's for women's history and one's for Black history, then by implication, all the other months are for white history.
Yeah, well, then you get all the TV documentaries and stuff going, oh, yeah, we'll come back next February when it's Black History Month. And they're probably on TV. Other 11 months, we're not relevant, right?
Right.
And let's worry about, you know, the Columbus statues and whether it should be Indigenous Peoples Day just for one day. And then after that, we can not worry about it for another year. But I think that the other thing is this sort of, maybe these are lazy solutions, right? Like, oh, let's just like one month be for Black history. That there we go, done. Okay, now let's move on. Yep. So I'm not sure if that's fair enough to say that. I think a lot of people put a lot of thought into trying to solve that problem, but it's a relatively, isn't it?
But it does feel lazy.
Yeah, and the other one is the sort of replacement idea, which there were lots of recent examples in Mexico, which probably are not going to be useful to include here, but we're talking about Columbus and Indigenous Peoples Day. So there's that idea, change it from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, which, you know, in a sense, I thoroughly endorse, right? But on the other hand, that doesn't stimulate debate and discussion, right? Mm-hmm. By doing the replacement, you it's like the lazy, quick way of coming to the end of the topic and then moving on. And then forgetting all about it. Yeah. Whereas if you call it Columbus and Indigenous Peoples Day, or Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day, and you have the two of them side by side, they don't sit side by side very comfortably. And it's inside that discomfort are possibilities for discussion and debate and education and so on, right? That's what I think, which of course, you know, gets me in trouble because then everybody's unhappy.
No, yeah, I hate, as a brown person, I hate positive discrimination as much as I hate discrimination. I think going, well, we have this university job, but you can only apply for it if you're Black or Asian, is just as bad as what got us here in the first place. It just feels like if someone offers me a job just so I can be the token brown person, I am as offended as if they would say to me, yeah, we only want white people on TV.
I mean, I think we're also hitting at something like, you know, monuments, because that's obviously where a lot of the conversations are, these different ways to commemorate, reflect, honor, whatever word you want to use. I'm also about, like, what are the meaningful, substantive ways we're changing a society, right? Wherever you are and whatever in that circumstance. So I'm thinking in the United States context, like, do I want Black History Month to go? No. Like, I want it to stay because it provides opportunities to tell these important stories, but it should be longer. But why can't we, beyond that month, talk about and actually make meaningful changes about inclusivity to access to education, right? And I'm not even talking just college. I'm talking, you know, we saw this last year where I worked in Augusta, Georgia, of like students of color did not have access to internet and computers to engage in remote work. And so what are we doing there? What are we doing with the generational issue of students of color who, or poor students in general, who are taking out massive loans that is riddling them for, like, I have a student loan that is more than my mortgage, for example. Yeah. That is ridiculous. And it's like, how are we working to actually uplift these communities, to protect them, to empower them in ways that will, you know, get them homes, get them fed, get them opportunities, employment, healthcare, right? Like, that's what I want to see. And I'm not saying get rid of those, but it's like actually doing policies that will impact positive ways. And I'm saying this even of universities, right? They'll put up a monument. They go, hey, this person was important at our school. And I'm like, how about a college scholarship or ships for people from that community? Because one thing I've seen at many institutions, and I'm not going to say which, is that the student body is predominantly privileged white men, right? So, and you see that the surrounding communities are Black, brown, whatever. They're not what the college campus looks like. And the people of color working on the campuses usually are in facilities or in different sports. And I'm not knocking those opportunities, but it's like, what about in presidential, leader, provost, dean, whatever, right? And how do we make the campus community the more inclusive? That's how we can change society in profound ways, because you have, their voices are heard. I don't know, whatever, I can go off on tangents on this. So.
Well, we should let you, because that segues us really nicely into what you are doing. Well, what we're doing is in me, you and Zach and nine other historians of a military background. We will talk to Amara and Matt as well about how they feel it go in outside of this. But tell everyone about the WSC, Holly.
I guess I'll take that reins. I mean, part of this is addressing something that's been an issue for a long time, and having a very inclusive organization, academic intellectual organization, that is not just limited to historians, is not just limited to those in subsets of various places of academia, to those who are independent scholars, those who are archivists, those who work in museum studies, those who do anything related to war and society, and not just limiting it to traditional military history. And I say the motivation for me, sorry, somebody's doing something outside. The motivation for me is my work has always been devalued by traditional Civil War scholars who would say things like, this is actually just African-American history, or this is just gender history. Or they'd say, this is too depressing. Like, I actually had that once during a presentation. A white scholar said, this story is too depressing. I said, welcome to being black. Right? I could tell you off camera.
Should we have happy history?
All happy history all the time.
Happy history, nothing depressing
bad in humanity at all, ever, is there?
So I've been put into what the subfield calls like the dark turn, which I'm like, that's racist, but that's another conversation. But it's like, we're talking about, for my work, it's about families, it's about communities, it's about disability, it's about issues of unemployment, it's about the war to be remembered, it's about pensions and understanding this federal social welfare program, that being the Civil War pension records. That's how we understand in totality, I believe, the war, in this case, the Civil War. And environmental historians push this even more in understanding, if you look at Black Civil War soldiers, most of them die because of the environment and racist policies, not from Confederate weaponry. So we need to be more inclusive in understanding that we should not privilege a select subset of people to shape the Civil War or any discourse on whatever the period is. And that's what excites me, is that we're trying, at least I hope, is create ways to get undergraduates, even high school students, excited to do and have these conversations, which they have all the time. But then also to make more accessible databases and archives and museums. And to me, what's awesome is there's limitless potential, because we're in this for all of the hell of COVID, and it is a lot. It's opened up these opportunities for conversations to happen virtually. Like, our conversations were with people whom I never met across the globe. And I'm bragging to my friends, like, I just talked to somebody over in, England today. And they're like, oh, you're a big deal. I'm like, well, I kind of am. Like, but it's like, it's fun. Like, the conversations are, very centered on how can we get more people engaged in this, and not just say this is a historian only group, or this is a PhD only group, or a graduate. Like, no, this is for, I'm going to tell my students.
The best query we had so far was the lady that came and went, do you take old lady librarians from Canada? Because I love this stuff. And it was like, hell yeah, we love old lady librarians. This is why we've called ourselves War and Society Collaborative, isn't it? Because it's about, we keep flogging this, not only war, but societies at war, because that is all part of the war as well.
I'm still reeling from this suggestion that you can only do happy military history. I'm not being funny, but if you're studying conflict and you're not depressed at least once in the course of what you're reading about,
then you're a sociopath, right?
Or you're not looking in the right places, or you're doing this kind of old white man style of military history.
There is happy military history. I got fed that when I was in school. It's all about the battles that the English won.
Yep, exactly.
Right? And the English went and beat all the baddies, didn't they?
Yeah, right.
Well, unemployment, disability. Like, one of the things that was the most shocking in my records was domestic abuse with what we know as PTSD, right? Yeah. So like that, these veteran husbands are trying to kill their wives and children because they're coming home with the shock of the war. And I'm not excusing it, but it's like, one of the bigger points is that the families are fighting each other to survive because the trauma of combat came home. And some of these soldiers will die in attics like animals in asylums. because, and it's like, there's, that's the war. That's the consequences of war. You know, Pickett's Charge or, you know, Sherman's March. Let's talk about Sherman's March and how it empowered enslaved people to find freedom. That's the reason, and others argue this, that's the reason Sherman's March is so controversial with quotes in the South, is because what it really did to liberation for enslaved people. That's the truth of it. But versus, this was oppressive in nature. No, it's not, to someone who was living in bondage. And those are, that, like, to me, that's what's exciting, is the field of history of academia is so diverse. Right? History of medicine, for example, LGBTQIA+, like, you name it. And it's like, that's what we need. And we need to not just look at, yes, I love the Civil War, but guess what? I recognize that most people don't, and I'm cool with that. But understanding how someone looking at the War of the Roses, somebody looking at colonial British, you know, oppression through capitulation, those are all important and gives us a better understanding of what war did to people, to environments, to animals, to plant, like, all of it. It matters.
It does. And if you're interested in that, follow at War and Society on Twitter, because we are just getting going. Be with us for the ride. It'll be epic. But, man, away from military history, what does the future hold? How do we make sure, are we going in the right direction already? And how do we make sure we stay going in the right direction?
I mean, what you were just describing, that sounds like the future of history. To respond to what Zach said earlier, that sounds like the future of history, right? Let's take the field of history that, I'm going to get into trouble here saying this, but some people would say is one of the, let's say, one of the more conservative
fields. Oh, hell yes. Yeah.
I don't know if that's fair to say.
It is.
Yeah, it is.
And then rethink it, right, kind of completely from the ground up, right? But not in a way that excludes anything. Not to say let's not ever talk about battles or those, you know, those generals, the famous generals, but to include everything, to get kind of a whole view. And I know this is going on. I'm not an expert in that, but I know in the study of the First World War, for example, a huge amount of work has been done on the society part of it. You know, if you're talking about your war and society, I think that principle that you're applying to looking at the military experience can be applied to all areas of history, all fields and topics. That same kind of idea. That's where history goes in the future. Although there is no future, you realize that there's only a thought.
Yeah. You know what? Interesting.
Every second that goes by was just, that's the past. I'm just saying.
What interests me is that a couple of people already have swatted at us for having, out of I think 11 on the committee, 3 white men. And I'm like, really? What? So do we not let white men on at all? Do they not get a say anymore? Are we not just part of the problem if we do that? And I'm sorry, but if our panel of military history is 70% gender and ethnic diverse, then I'm going to say go bite me, basically, because I think we're doing really well.
I mean, to your point, we don't ever need mannels either. We don't need an all-male panel. Like, that's a big problem. Like, if I see those, I'm good.
A mannel.
I love that. Mannel.
I stole that. God, I did not create that. I want to say.
Life. Oh, God. Yeah. I was thinking as everybody was speaking, I've been quiet here for a while, just taking it all in. But essentially, the public, scholars, our administrators, we're all going to have to become very comfortable with messiness.
Yes.
None of this is going to be easy. And again, that kind of post-Enlightenment unidirectional narrative that we know is bullshit, right? Yeah. It just means that all these perspectives are going to make everything a hell of a lot messier.
And you know what? History is messy. Look at the world out now. It's messy.
Humans are messy.
It's also want to write the history of the 21st century in 200 years' time. Screw
it's also spicy, and I like a little bit of spicy.
We like it when it's spicy. Yes, exactly. I mean, it makes it so much more interesting and to be inclusive, right?
I think as well, like people say, like, oh, but I just teach people about the Nazis and Hitler because it's what they're interested in. I'm sorry, but if you're a historian and you're good at your job, you'll get people excited about your subject.
Yep. I mean, I've always break my students' heart for a Civil War course. I'm like, so I'm just going to start off. We're never going to talk about a battle like the way you think. Like, this is going to have a social, historical, gendered focus. So we'll get a battle, just not what you thought.
And Gone with the Wind can suck it.
Oh, God. Well, that's a whole nother.
That's another podcast, Alex. We're going to book that in a minute.
I think I just wanted to say real quick, like the where I think the we can continue to go is being more getting the public involved. And I say this just in terms of people talk about history all the time, every day, right? They talk about these things, but it's like if they feel like they're active participants with various, you know, so people who do public history, which I think is amazing, digital history, that to me is like that's pushed how I think of history and how I engage with people. If our professions are going to survive, we need to make it more, like we said in a meeting once, fun. Mm-hmm. When we talk about this stuff, it needs to be fun. It is fun. It's frustrating. It can be depressing. You know, if I'm talking about Jim Crow, I'm not going to lie. I'm very sad for that day. But I also look at the flip side is that they didn't give up.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's the part. And it can be empowering even when we look at oppression. But sometimes history is just like, can we just laugh at this thing that's happening right now?
Yeah.
Like in whatever, right? Like, especially if you're
trying. We have a History Hack mug and it's a Kit quote from Down the Pub on our merch store. And basically right. The quote just says, it would be funny if all these people hadn't died. Because it is, history's full of fun stuff. If
right.
A big enough history nerd will be able to make you laugh with any subject going. Any subject.
I mean, this sounds a bit cliche, but are we essentially saying, look, can we just start putting some of the humanity back into this? That we kind of we sucked a lot of the humanity out with those old tropes that we talked about put these people up on a pedestal and weren't they wonderful? And there's one way of understanding this story. And now what we've done over, you know, the past 50 years, but particularly now going, okay, can we start talking about actual people and diverse groups of people rather than just.
And how all of the stuff was happening, like my biggest beef, you know, my biggest beef with the First World War is I've done a Western Front book. Well, I've done an Eastern Front book. Well, I'm telling you, nobody divided them up during the war. It was one huge cluster bomb of messiness all happening at the same time. Just because you need to arrange a narrative doesn't mean you can put history into little boxes. The boxes don't exist.
Ooh, you just literally took part of my introduction. I was saying something like in there about, you know, historians for a long time have tried to put, you know, they said that the Civil War defined these people or reconstruct whatever period, right? That defined the people. And I'm saying, no, the people define those moments. And they like, so that's how we need to understand them, that they're people living through these very important, like now that we understand times and stop saying, well, the Civil War era, it's like, no, these people in this moment, this is what they did in their different ways. There is no singular way to talk about the Black experience in the diasporic sense, even the white male experience. It's not universal because when I talk to students about, hey, did you know white men oppressed other white men sometimes because they were poor? So yeah. Even when we talk about whiteness and racism, we have to add classism, religion, right? Like then you understand how messy it even is to understand whiteness. They don't agree on what is, quote, true, you know, white male, you know, woman, whatever.
One thing I've always wanted to do, and if anybody steals this idea, I will come for you. I've always wanted to rewrite Gone with the Wind from the point of view of Sam, the slave that he kind of pops up in and out, or from Mammy's point of view about how literally she can't stand Scarlett and wants to whip the living daylights out of her because she's a monster. And do Mammy's Civil War.
And, I will take anything other, like, because, yeah, Gone with the Wind, whatever, that's a whole, ugh.
And on that note, having bashed them with the wind.
So the people got rich off it. I'm sure they'll get over it.
Frankly, Zach, I don't give a damn.
There we go. That's it. That's the first. That's it. There we go. That's the wrap. Right there.
Thank you, Holly. Brilliant.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.